This month, Jay Leno starts his highly anticipated new gig as host of a 10 o'clock show on NBC. Of course, Leno's most well known for being the king of late night as host of The Tonight Show. But this morning, we're going to take a look back at the time and place where Leno and many other big name comedians got their start. Los Angeles in the 1970s.
I'm originally from the East. I've been living out here about 4 months. You know, I can't get used to living out here. I don't know how many of you are from New York. The beach is on the wrong side.
That was Leno with black hair and a plaid shirt, same big chin, right after he arrived in L.A. so poor that the police picked him up, thinking he was homeless. Another young comedian came to L.A. a few months later from Indiana. His name was David Letterman.
I just got back from Reno, stayed at a condominium up there, and really a cheap condominium. Had one of those whirlpools, you know what a whirlpool jacuzzi is? I think it was a cheap jacuzzi, though, because when everybody got in the water, we had to take turns going...
Leno and Letterman were joined by Robin Williams, Andy Kaufman, Richard Lewis, and many other household names-to-be during what our guest calls stand-up comedy's golden era. Bill Nadelsieder was a reporter for the L.A. Times at the time. He was covering the burgeoning comedy scene, and his new book is called I'm Dying Up Here, Heartbreak and High Times in Stand-Up Comedy's Golden Era. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Why do you call the stand-up comedy's golden era?
Well, in Los Angeles, people were arriving by the week from all around the country. You know, class clowns from all over the place just picked up and moved, invariably inspired by sitting there watching the Tonight Show and hearing Johnny Carson say, now here's a young comic who's appearing here in town at the Comedy Store. And boom, that was it. They heard that and they packed their bags and headed to L.A. thinking that if they just got on this stage at this place called the Comedy Store, well, they would be on Carson and they would be comedians. Before long, you had 300, young comics living in West Hollywood around the Comedy Store trying to get on that stage.
But Los Angeles was not always the hub for comedy. Early in your book, you talk about Johnny Carson moving The Tonight Show from New York to the West Coast.
Well, that was the most significant thing because Johnny Carson was the prime arbiter of what was funny in America for a very long time. If he thought you were funny and put you on his show, you had a career. If he didn't, you didn't have a career.
This world that you write about was so densely packed with talent. What impact did that tight-knit community have on the comedy that these guys were doing?
It was absolutely electric, and they would all share stuff, and they would write stuff down on napkins, and they'd be hanging out at the bar between sets. I mean, and, it's hard to imagine now, but that you on a random Friday night, you could see Letterman and Leno and Richard Lewis and Robin Williams and Elaine Boozler all on the same stage.
Will you read a passage from the book that kind of captures a bit of that sense? This is on page 106.
Ringo Starr made a memorable solo appearance at Sunset one night, arriving so intoxicated that Mike Binder, who was working the door, had to help him to a seat and back. Starr was seated just as David Letterman took the stage, and the former Beatle immediately began heckling him, which attracted the attention of every comic with an earshot. Letterman had a reputation for eviscerating hecklers, and as word spread along the back hallway, other comics started filing into the room to watch the impending bloodshed. It wasn't a fair fight. In the spotlight, Letterman couldn't see who the heckler was, so he showed no mercy, and Starr was too drunk to appreciate how badly Letterman was beating him up. Finally, one of the comics took pity and called out, "Hey, Dave, it's Ringo." "Oh, that makes sense," Letterman shot back in the direction of Starr. "You ruined your career, and now you've come here to ruin mine." George Miller almost fell off his stool laughing.
Were you there that night?
No, I was not. I was there on other nights, but not that one.
In the center of this book, you have a collection of photographs, and there's one that I just have to ask you about. It shows Andy Kaufman posturing in a full-length robe that looks like it could be made out of silk. The caption on the photo says, "Andy Kaufman getting ready to wrestle on the author's patio, November 1978.
Okay.
What's the story?
All right. I was set to do a profile on Andy from for the LA Times. And we had the interview set up for a couple of days ahead. And one night around 7 or 8 o'clock, my phone rang. And, "Hi, it's Andy. Can I come over?" And I was sort of taking it back. "Well, sure. Come on over." And about a half an hour later, Andy Kaufman showed up at my front door, and he had a cardboard vaudevillian suitcase with him. And he insisted on performing his entire act in pantomime while I took pictures, complete with three costume changes.
An audience of one.
Myself and my wife, who was 8 months pregnant at the time. And he wanted to wrestle her. And that was
his.
No. No. But there is a funny picture of him, staring her down like he was going to wrestle her.
so many of the people you write about in this book died before their time. Is it difficult to see the immense talent that is no longer with us?
Yeah. Well, that sort of happened with that generation in comedy and rock and roll. I think there was probably more drugs in the rock and roll arena.
Although you write about all-night cocaine sessions with the comedians.
Yep, that did happen. But it wasn't part of the comedy lifestyle. There were some who did that. There were a lot of them who didn't. I mean, Jay Leno was an absolute straight arrow. Letterman, they didn't do that. And comics didn't make enough money to buy cocaine. They were lucky to buy pot.
Robin Williams had the line that cocaine is God's way of telling you you're making too much money.
A very true statement.
Well, we're having this conversation on the eve of Jay Leno's new show. It would seem appropriate to go out with a clip of his first ever appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
One, yeah.
See, my folks grew up during the Depression. So consequently, they make you feel very guilty about everything, I mean, even now I go home for a weekend. Hey, Dad, pass the salt.
We never had salt when we were kids. We had to live without salt. We didn't have underwear or potatoes. We ate dirt every day of the week. Your mother and I hunted wild dog for food. We had nothing when we were your age.
Bill Nadelsider, what do you think?
I remember that Jay Leno. He told me this. He said, that he could sell a joke that really wasn't that funny because he had a lot of attitude and he could with his voice and all that. Letterman didn't quite have that brio, so he had to write better jokes was the issue. They were sort of a mutual admiration society back then. In separate interviews, I asked each of them, okay, so, whose act among your peers do you most admire? And each of them instantly named the other.
Bill Nadelsider, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bill Nadelsider is the author of I'm Dying Up Here, Heartbreak and High Times in Stand-Up Comedy's Golden Era. And you'll find clips of Leno and Letterman's early performances in L.A., plus an excerpt of William Nadelsider's new book on our website, npr.org.
On April 9th, 1947, a headline in the New York Times read, "Body of Collier is found near where brother died." It was a tale that transfixed the city, the reclusive Collier brothers, and the search for Langley Collier's body weeks after his paralyzed brother Homer had been found dead in their once stately home on Fifth Avenue. The brothers had cut themselves off from the world, secluded themselves in a house piled floor to ceiling with everything imaginable, decades worth of newspapers, 14 pianos, the chassis of a Model T Ford. You could read this description the next day in the Times, that Langley was inching through a tunnel of junk when he touched off his own booby trap, only 8 feet from Homer. Pinned to the dank, rotting flooring, Langley, when found Tuesday, had stretched his gnarled fingers toward his helpless brother. Langley, the eccentric collector, and his blind brother Homer are the latest subject for E.L. Doctorow, who in many novels has transformed real characters of American history into fiction. In Doctorow's new novel, Homer and Langley, he takes us inside that brownstone with Homer as his narrator.
The house by this time of our lives was a labyrinth of hazardous pathways full of obstructions and many dead ends. With enough light, someone could make his way through the zigzagging corridors of newspaper bales or find passage by slipping sideways between piles of equipment of one kind or another, the guts of pianos, motors wrapped in their power cords, boxes of tools, paintings, car body parts, tires, stacked chairs, tables on tables, headboards, barrels, collapsed stacks of books, antique lamps, dislodged pieces of our parents' furniture, rolled-up carpet, piles of clothing, bicycles. But it needed the native gifts of a blind man who sensed where things were by the air they displaced to get from one room to another without killing himself in the process.
E.L. Doctorow remembers being 16 when the Collier brothers' bodies were discovered.
And it was a big story in the newspapers and everyone was talking about it. They became instant folklore. And then, not long after that, when I was a teenager, and this is not my experience alone as a boy, my mother looked in on my room and said, "My God, it's the Collier brothers." And
that would be the sign, it's time to clean up your room.
They were always on my mind. I mean, there were other people all over the city who were doing that kind of thing, and still exists, this sort of pack ratage. But somehow the fact that they had come from a well-to-do family and had more or less opted out was the real mystery of them, I thought.
Yeah, the father was a doctor. They had this mansion, I guess you could call it, on Fifth Avenue. Both boys had gone to Columbia. They presumably had everything they could have wanted.
Well, yeah, and then somewhere along the line they opted out. Of course, my Collier brothers are the mythical Collier brothers. They are the real Collier brothers, and then they're the mythical presences in our minds. And I never felt it necessary to do any research on this. They required interpretation, not research.
So you didn't go back to read the accounts of what was found, what they collected, just what was found, more than 100 tons of debris?
I think
debris.
It was possible to describe what they'd collected without actually looking anything like that up, because they collected everything. You couldn't miss. Whatever you decide they collected, they would have.
It would have been in there.
But to me, the key thing was not that they were aggregators. We are all aggregators. Maybe people like that in other countries, but we're certainly the champs when it comes to collecting things and accumulating things. I figured to myself the really interesting thing was why they had closed the door and the shutters and retreated into this house. It was a form of almost emigration. They were leaving the country and going into the country of their home. So the problem for me, as I became more and more fascinated with the idea of doing a book, was how to break into that house and see what was going on and why. Actually, I couldn't have done this book had I not found the first line for it. First line is, "I'm Homer, the blind brother." And once I had that, it was a way of breaking into this story and into this house.
Why was that such a key?
I don't know, but first lines are very crucial, usually, for the beginnings of books. They give you the voice. They imply the kind of texture the text will have. And in effect, and this is more clearly seen, I think, in short stories than in novels, they are the acorn from which the oak grows. They predict you can find the entire book in that first line.
So when you put yourself into Homer's place, the blind brother, who by the end of the novel is also going deaf, I mean, the walls are closing around him in every possible way. How do you make him other than a complete eccentric, someone who engages in behavior along with his brother Langley that is just impossible to fathom?
Homer is a very compassionate, sensitive fellow, as I read him, and with a good sense of humor. And he accepts his brother's eccentricities and even values them. I think the issue for him is to create meaning out of their lives in this peculiar, eccentric decision they've made.
And he has a poignant line. You have a poignant line towards the end of the book when he is, in writing his story, typing out his story, he says, "What could be more terrible than being turned into a mythic joke?"
Yeah. I really felt bad when he said that.
Hmm. You felt bad?
Yeah. You know, after you get into the book, you're really living with these people and you're living in the sentences. And their experience kind of becomes yours. It's a peculiar kind of loss of identity that the author has. And when he said that, when Homer said that, I really felt sad.
Did you have to get up and walk around?
No, I didn't feel that sad. I went on to the next line.
You know, I'm trying to imagine this scene when the Langley brothers died in 1947, and the police were going through the house, throwing everything out, trying to find the bodies. There was a gigantic crowd of people who gathered outside. Thousands of people came to watch or drive by.
Yeah, they were famous by then, perhaps because they represented in extreme form what everybody was like, in a sense. And I do think of them in my reading as a kind of curators of their life and times. and their house is a kind of a museum of American civilization.
E.L. Doctorow, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Well, I've enjoyed it.
E.L. Doctorow's new novel is Homer and Langley. You can hear more of our conversation and read an excerpt from the book at thenewnpr.org.
One of public television's most popular children's programs concludes a 26-year run today. Reading Rainbow has entertained millions of kids and won scores of awards. The decision to end the show signals a change in philosophy as to how television should teach reading, as Ben Calhoun reports.
Even if you can't remember a specific Reading Rainbow episode, chances are the theme song is still stuck in your head somewhere.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high.
Reading Rainbow started in 1983, hosted by actor LeVar Burton. If you don't know Burton from Reading Rainbow, he's also famous for his role as Kunta Kinte in Roots or the chrome-visored Geordi LaForge on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Hey! I'm glad you're here.
Each episode of Reading Rainbow had the same basic elements. There was a featured children's book, and then an adventure with Burton that related back to the featured book. The third part to all of this was the book reviews. Towards the end of the show, kids appeared on screen and recommended books to each other.
Yo, my name is Pete, and I got a book for you. It's all about music, and I think you'll dig it too.
Hi there. My name is Laura Delgado, and I'm here today to tell you about a very special book I've just finished reading.
Hello up there in outer space. My name is Carlos Rodriguez. Well, boy, have I got a book for you.
But it wasn't just the structure of the show that made it stand out. It was the substance.
We're going on a hayride down to Smiley Hollow for a good old-fashioned Tennessee barn dance.
The show had light themes like barn dances and honeybees, but it never shied away from tougher issues.
Not all of us have experienced what it's like to have a parent in prison, but millions of children have.
In 26 years, Reading Rainbow won more than 24 Emmys and became the third longest-running children's show in PBS history. It's topped only by Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers.
The series resonates with so many people.
John Grant is in charge of content at WNED, Reading Rainbow's home station. Grant says Reading Rainbow is ending today because nobody, not the station, not PBS, not CPB, nobody's putting up the money to renew the show's broadcast rights, a cost of several $100,000. He says that partially has to do with a funding crunch. But more interesting, Grant says the decision to end Reading Rainbow can also be traced back to a philosophical change about TV and reading. He says the change started with the Department of Education under the Bush administration, which wanted to see a much heavier focus on things like phonics and spelling, the basic tools of reading.
And so PBS and CPB and the Department of Education all put significant funding really toward the idea of programming that would teach kids how to read.
Reading Rainbow was not what they wanted.
That was never what Reading Rainbow did. Reading Rainbow taught kids why to read, you know, the love of reading, encouraged kids to pick up a book and to read.
I think in many ways Reading Rainbow, in terms of literacy, represents the era that it was developed in.
Linda Siminski is the vice president of children's programming at PBS.
I think maybe in the early 80s, the thought was, how do we get kids to read books?
Siminski says Reading Rainbow came up against research that shows teaching the mechanics of reading should be the network's priority.
We've been able to identify the earliest steps that we need to take. You know, now we know what we need to do first. Even just from 5 years ago, I think we all know so much more about how to use television to teach.
It sounds like to me that the research has directed people towards phonics fundamentals as the front line of the literacy fight, and Reading Rainbow occupied a little bit more luxurious space, assuming those skills and being a show that was about reveling in the joy of reading.
Exactly, exactly.
Kind of off the front line.
Yeah, exactly.
Siminski calls Reading Rainbow's 26-year run miraculous and calls its end bittersweet. Still, talking to others in children's programming, it seems Reading Rainbow's impending absence hangs like an open question about the literacy challenges that still exist and the role television should play to meet those challenges. For NPR News, I'm Ben Calhoun in New York.